November 11th, this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, despite President Trump and Republicans' refusal to acknowledge Joe Biden's White House win, the president-elect says it won't hurt his transition.
It does not change the dynamic at all in what we're able to do.
It appears Republican efforts to overturn the health care law known as Obamacare may face another defeat. Also ahead, despite the pandemic, a West African poetry slam lives on. It's all on today's International Edition. President-elect Joe Biden is confronting the nation's health crisis as concerns grow that the Republican Party's fierce refusal to acknowledge his victory is hurting the incoming administration's transition. Biden was asked by reporters Tuesday about how President Trump's refusal to concede the election could impact his transition process.
We're going to do exactly what we'd be doing if he had conceded and said we've won, which we have. And so there's nothing really changing.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Tuesday also appeared to brush aside the presidential election results, showing President Trump lost his bid for a second term.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration.
When asked by reporters about Pompeo's comments, Biden smiled and downplayed concerns about the president's and Republicans' resistance.
I just think it's an embarrassment, quite frankly. The only thing that, how can I say this tactfully? I think it will not help the president's legacy.
News reports say President Trump's refusal to concede could be why government officials are not cooperating with the president-elect's transition team. Joining us for more on what it could mean if a president continues to refuse accepting the election results is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon. Jeff, with the lack of cooperation with the transition and comments by the nation's top diplomat, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are there concerns about how all of this could impact national security?
There are some concerns indeed by people who have been watching the national security process, not just in this administration, but in previous administrations. And in the tradition of the Trump administration, it's an administration that doesn't necessarily adhere to norms when it comes to this type of thing. I would note that in his remarks when Secretary Pompeo said there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. He also said the world's watching. We're going to count all the votes. And he also said there's a process, and that he also said the world should have every confidence that the transition necessary to make sure that State Department is functional will go on. So he had a caveat to some of his remarks, but it struck a lot of people as a bit out of the norm. There's also concern because part of the traditional transition process involves the General Services Administration, which is a body within the U.S. government, making a determination that there's likely going to be a transition, and that allows a bunch of things to take place in terms of major departments like the intelligence community, the Defense Department, the State Department, starting to communicate and allowing teams from the incoming administration to communicate, to ease the transition. The GSA has yet to make that determination, and as of yet, as a result, neither the Defense Department, the State Department, or the intelligence community has been participating in any of these normal transition discussions. President-elect Biden, for his part, has said he's not worried. He said that the transition is, quote, well underway, and that he's got teams in place and things are going to go on, regardless of what the reaction of the current administration is.
Wouldn't it be difficult, though, if he's not able to get intelligence briefings? And also, of course, we're seeing more people, high-ranking people within national security-type positions that are resigning.
There's been a lot of change over most recently at the Pentagon, where in just the last couple of days, the president has essentially ousted. He fired the Secretary of Defense, Mike Esper, who's now been replaced by an acting Secretary of Defense who's been pulled from the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center. Some of the chief policy people at the Defense Department have also now left, a couple of them in place with Trump loyalists, and that's concerned incoming Democrats. And the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee put out a statement saying that as soon as it became apparent that former Vice President Joe Biden was President-elect Joe Biden, that the Trump administration decided and embarked on a path of spreading chaos and destruction, and that that was not in the best interests of U.S. national security. So there's a lot of politics going on here, but as the Biden transition team has pointed out, even if they were getting some of the intelligence briefings right now, President-elect Biden is not the president, and while it would be good to give him some of the background, he wouldn't be making decisions on any information yet anyway. The Biden transition team has also compiled quite a staff of team leaders to help with the transition. Many of them are experienced, people like the former chief of the Defense Intelligence Agency, former deputy undersecretaries of state, former deputy intelligence. So they have, in terms of some of the critical agencies, they have a lot of experience on these teams. And the hope is that because of that, no matter what happens with the transition with the Trump administration, they'll be able to hit the ground running.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon, thanks for being with us. President-elect Joe Biden has spoken with leaders of three of the United States' most important European allies. Joining us for details is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, let's start with your president, Emmanuel Macron.
French President Emmanuel Macron congratulated President-elect Joe Biden, and in that video conference really stressed that France is America's oldest ally and reassured Joe Biden that America and France can work together on some of the really difficult contemporary issues. And let's look at them. Climate change, health, the fight against terrorism, defending fundamental rights. These are the issues that France feels should be addressed. In particular, they are so looking forward to having a new commitment from the United States to fighting climate change, a return to the Paris Climate Agreement. They're also looking to the United States for a commitment to development and security in Africa, particularly to the Sahel. They really want renewed U.S. support there. And again, we're also back looking at the Iran nuclear deal. Will that be renegotiated? Will there be some step forward in bringing everyone back around the table? So it was in that spirit that Emmanuel Macron really was digging into these very, very traditional ties that bind France and the United States.
And then there's Germany. Angela Merkel spoke with President-elect Biden as well, and that also seemed to be very positive.
Indeed, she expressed the wish for close and trusting future cooperation. I think what you have to remember about Angela Merkel is she knows Joe Biden. They worked well together when he was vice president. On top of that, there was a very emotional speech by the German chancellor on Monday, which was the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that was really her remembering that America has got such an important role in contemporary as well as post-war German history. The whole transatlantic relationship is the bedrock of Germany's stability. They remember that America was in Germany at the end of the Second World War. They remember that speech that then President Ronald Reagan made at the Brandenburg Gate, calling on the Berlin Wall to be knocked down. They know that. And that is why Angela Merkel is so attached to the idea that America will move away from the position that it's been in the last 4 years, particularly its relationship with NATO. Angela Merkel is really looking forward to having an America that is just as engaged in NATO, but is less focused on the spending doctrine of NATO. So she was very enthusiastic about this. And you could really see, not just in her remarks after she'd spoken to President-elect Biden, but also the remarks on Monday, that for Germany, multilateralism, these sorts of relationships are what the world needs if they're going to move out of the multiple crises that the world is facing at the moment.
Also interesting, Catherine, was UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has been very close and supportive of President Donald Trump, also spoke to Biden.
Indeed, the United Kingdom always talks about this special relationship that they have with the United States. And for Boris Johnson at the moment, they're looking at a delicate couple of months ahead as they change their trading relationship with many countries as they move out of the European Union, it was important for Boris Johnson to make positive remarks about President-elect Biden. So yes, Boris Johnson is very keen on the Paris Climate Agreement. There is the hope still that the climate conference will take place in 2021. So looking ahead at that, but also, you know, let's not forget that the United Kingdom does need a trade agreement with the United States and is very keen on that. And as well, still hoping to generate this idea that the special relationship that operates between London and Washington will continue to be special in the next 4 years.
These three leaders obviously had a lot of very hopeful and positive things to say. It sounds like others are more cautious, including EU leader Ursula von der Leyen.
Yeah, she is very positive. I mean, most European leaders are, but she came out and said, warned actually, that the election of Joe Biden will not be a silver bullet for transatlantic relations. And she has actually called for a new agenda for today's world. And she pointed out in her remarks that the US has changed over the last few years. And she said people should not expect everything to go back to what it was 4 years ago or go back to what the world was even before that. And said, perhaps now is the time when everyone should be looking at how multilateralism is working and how huge economies and huge societies like the United States and like the European Union nations, how they work together in a very complicated world.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks as always. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan congratulated President-elect Joe Biden on Tuesday, expressing Turkey's determination to work closely with the new administration. Turkey was one of a handful of countries, along with Russia, that had not commented on Biden's victory since he was declared the winner of the U.S. presidential election on Saturday. And while attention has been focused on the U.S. presidential race over the past week, Americans across the U.S. also voted to reform some of the country's restrictive drug laws. VOA's Jason Patinkin reports.
After the birth of her second child, Melissa Lavassani fell into postpartum depression.
It really was a year of just terrible, like a year of suicidal thoughts.
Lavassani, a budget officer at the Washington, D.C. city government, declined to take antidepressants because she feared their side effects. Other treatments didn't seem to work either, so with nothing left to lose, she opted for something radical, psychedelic drugs, which she had never used before. They were illegal, but medical researchers have found them to be potentially effective for treating some forms of depression.
It was a life or death decision at that point. I had to try something because I was going to take my life. I knew they were illegal. I knew it was a Schedule I drug, and I could get into a lot of trouble if anyone found out. But again, I was choosing my life to do this.
Lavassani started taking psilocybin mushrooms and a plant-based brew called ayahuasca, both of which produce intense hallucinations. The change was almost immediate.
Within a matter of days, I felt human again. I was starting to engage with my children and, you know, communicate with my husband better. And there was really tangible changes. It was like a brand new lease on life.
Lavassani had found healing, but she remained frustrated that her treatment had been illegal. So last year, she launched a campaign to make it easier for people to use psychedelic plants and fungi in Washington, D.C. And last week, 76% of D.C. voters approved a ballot measure to make psychedelics the lowest law enforcement priority in the city. It was part of a wave of successful ballot measures across the U.S. this election season, seeking to loosen drug laws. In the northwestern state of Oregon, 58% of voters chose to decriminalize possession of all drugs. And voters in Arizona, New Jersey, Montana, and South Dakota approved the legalization of marijuana. The southern state of Mississippi also approved the medical use of marijuana. Marijuana is now legal in 15 U.S. states, plus Washington, D.C. In 33 other states, plus Puerto Rico, it is allowed for some medical use. Matt Sutton, a spokesman for the Drug Policy Alliance, which backed various measures to reform drug laws, says the election results show that drug law reform cuts across America's deep political divides.
This isn't a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's something that all Americans care about.
Sutton says one reason the issue has wide appeal is because harsh anti-drug laws have disproportionately impacted communities of color. That makes drug policy a key area for reform as the U.S. undergoes an unprecedented reckoning over racial injustice. Another reason is the growing belief that drug use is a public health issue, not a criminal issue. That's the thinking behind the new Oregon law. It says people found with small amounts of drugs won't face jail time. Instead, they'll either pay a $100 fine or attend new addiction recovery centers funded by tax revenue from Oregon's legal marijuana industry.
What we heard from Oregonians is that, you know, they wanted a better approach to drugs, you know, that people understood this as the public health issue that it was and not something that should be criminalized. And you can't treat a public health issue with jails or prisons.
Not everyone thinks it's a good idea. News media quote district attorneys and law enforcement officials in Oregon as calling the measure reckless and saying it would increase public acceptance of dangerous drugs. But Sutton says the Oregon law draws heavily from the experience of Portugal, which in 2000 decriminalized possession of small amounts of hard drugs. Studies show the drug use has not grown in Portugal and drug deaths dropped. But in the U.S., drug overdose deaths have surged in recent years, despite a decades-long war on drugs that prioritized law enforcement. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control says almost 70,000 Americans died of accidental overdoses in 2018.
I mean, it doesn't seem like what we're doing is working, right? Because we're spending an exorbitant amount of money criminalizing people, arresting them, prosecuting them, jailing them, when we could be using those resources to fund services such as what this measure does. You know, this measure takes excess tax revenue from marijuana tax and also law enforcement cost savings to fund health services.
Here in Washington, Lavasani, who used psychedelics to treat depression, says she thinks as local laws change, national laws may be next.
It's going to take some time and a lot of education with our lawmakers, but you know, we've convinced the D.C. residents that this is a positive thing and the research is there. And I think that we can do the same with our federal lawmakers.
In the meantime, she hopes those struggling with depression can find healing without fear. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
Another Republican bid to strike down the entire Affordable Care Act appears likely to fail. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In the Supreme Court's third big case on the law known as Obamacare, Republicans argue the court should find the law's mandate for obtaining health insurance unconstitutional and wipe out the whole thing. Two conservative justices were among those appearing unwilling, with Chief Justice John Roberts noting Congress zeroed out the penalty for failing to obtain health care.
Congress left the rest of the law intact.
Trump appointee Brett Kavanaugh says recent court decisions suggest the proper remedy is to cut out the mandate and leave the rest of the act in place, a move the court's three liberal justices would presumably join. Sagar Magani, Washington.
As we reported on Monday, a vaccine for the coronavirus has proved 90% effective after early trials, according to its joint developers, Pfizer and BioNTech. It's raising hopes that the global coronavirus pandemic could be brought under control in the coming months. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, the nature of the vaccine means less developed health systems face major challenges in rolling out any inoculation programs.
The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine trial is still in its early stages, but scientists say results so far from 44,000 volunteers show the virus can be beaten. The vaccine is based on new so-called mRNA technology and is yet to be approved by regulators. Even if it's fast-tracked, there are other challenges.
There are big manufacturing challenges. There are logistics challenges. This vaccine needs to be stored at minus 80 degrees Celsius.
That's more feasible in richer nations. But in poorer countries, rolling out a vaccination program won't be easy. At this clinic in Burkina Faso, the fridge regularly breaks down, forcing staff to throw away the medicines inside. The United Nations says health systems that serve two-thirds of the world's population don't have adequate refrigeration facilities.
So if today we had to vaccinate against the coronavirus, for example, we would need a lot more refrigerators to keep the vaccines. We don't have these fridges.
Then there's the problem of power.
The hot climate means that the cooling devices are more important and have to work harder. It's a lack of electricity. It's developing economy. So if you look in a number of these markets, you can find areas where countries where perhaps 30, 40% of the health centres don't have access to electricity.
The United Nations Children's Fund spent $85 million in 2019 on refrigeration equipment, mostly solar-powered refrigerators in Africa and Asia. It's also stockpiling syringes and developing cold chain storage and transportation ahead of any vaccine approval. But in many countries, scientists say the health infrastructure simply doesn't exist to roll out any rapid coronavirus inoculation program. An added challenge is getting people to clinics or visiting them in the community and persuading them the vaccine is safe. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine requires 2 doses per person. Then there's the danger of vaccine nationalism, the concern that rich countries buy up all the vaccines for their own populations. Over 150 countries have signed up to a global facility called COVAX to try to ensure equitable distribution.
With the goal being to help produce 2 billion doses of various COVID vaccines that could be distributed to all of these countries around the world by the end of 2021.
Scientists say other coronavirus vaccines currently in trials also could prove effective, boosting hopes of large-scale inoculation programs. But they warn until such programs are rolled out, it's vital that governments and individuals continue to try to suppress the spread of the virus as infection rates continue to soar. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
VOA's International Edition continues. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat died Tuesday of COVID-19 after weeks in an Israeli hospital. For decades, Erekat negotiated with Israel over a two-state solution. He was known for being tough at the bargaining table, as Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas declared 3 days of mourning for 65-year-old Saeb Erekat, who died Tuesday from COVID-19. For decades, he was at the forefront of the negotiations with Israel over an independent Palestinian state. Speaking earlier this year, Erekat said the two-state solution remains the only viable option for a lasting peace.
The real alternative to a state of Palestine living side by side, the state of Israel in peace and security on the 1967 lines, is one democratic secular state where Jews, Muslims, and Christians can live equal, with equal votes. Those who believe that they can undermine the two-state solution and replace it with what I call one state, two systems, maintaining the status quo now, apartheid, I don't think in the 21st century they will get away with it. It's impossible.
He was sharply critical after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain normalized relations with Israel, calling them Arab Zionists and saying they had stabbed the Palestinians in the back with a poison dagger. In Israel, some current and former officials said Erekat was a moderate who sought peace. Former Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni said she was saddened by his death, that he dedicated his life to his people, and used to say that peace was his destiny. But others had a far harsher view. Yair Netanyahu, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's son, said Erekat was a terrorist who worked for the destruction of the State of Israel. Among Palestinians, many saw Arakat as an effective advocate, including Palestinian politician Mustafa Barghouti, who spoke to the BBC.
Dr. Saeb was a fighter for Palestinian rights. He was a well-known and astonished diplomat, and he ran lots of negotiations on behalf of Palestinians, and he was the Secretary General of the PLO. So, of course, it's a big loss for everybody. But I must say that he did not stop working, even when he knew that he was risking his life, given the spread of the coronavirus. And unfortunately, he is now an additional and another victim of this horrible virus.
Arakat was in charge of the negotiations that eventually led to the signing of the 1993 Oslo Accords, which laid out a roadmap for the peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that included Palestinian self-determination. In the decades since, both Israelis and Palestinians have moved away from the Oslo Accords, and in the past years, talks have been frozen. Arakat became the Secretary General of the PLO in 2015. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Mali, known for its music and cultural events, attracted artists from around West Africa to this year's annual Slam Poetry Festival. Journalist Annie Reisenberg followed one young Malian poet who is bucking stereotypes in the conservative nation.
Mali this year struggled with an Islamist insurgency, a worldwide pandemic, and an August military coup, all of which left most cultural events in the West African nation in shambles. But Mali's annual International Festival of Slam and Humor, FISH, was merely delayed until November, after a post-coup curfew was lifted. 23-year-old Malian Aisha Diarra first learned of competitive performance poetry, slam poetry, when her high school held a contest. She has been a slam poet ever since, and competes at FISH every year. Diarra sees her art as a form of activism to highlight the struggles of Malian women and girls. Sitting on a graffiti-covered rooftop in Bamako, she says many of the topics in her poems are considered taboo in conservative Mali. Diarra says that people often think the subjects she writes about in her lyrics are too bold. When I talk about circumcision of young girls, she says, it is generally a taboo subject in Africa. Others congratulate me, says Diarra, because there are many who do not dare to venture there. Slam poetry is a relatively new music scene in Mali, a country with deep musical traditions that is seen as a cultural crossroads in Africa. Slam poetry first appeared in Mali in 2006, years after it gained popularity in the United States, and FISH started in 2014. The annual festival is run by Malian group Akhredatoire, founded by one of Mali's first slam poets, Aziz Kone. Kone explains how he came up with a theme for this year's festival, peace and social cohesion.
Comme vous le savez, tout le monde le sait, depuis 2012, le Mali est fragilisé par une crise.
As you know, says Kone, everyone knows it. Since 2012, Mali has been weakened by a security crisis, by a social crisis. So, we saw that it is important for us today to hold this festival, he says, in the name of peace and social cohesion. Just days before the festival, the region's former colonial power, France, launched airstrikes in central Mali that killed more than 50 jihadists. Mali has been struggling against an Islamist insurgency spreading in the Sahel region, along with thousands of UN and French troops. Anger over the ongoing conflict fueled mass protests that led the military in August to oust President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. Despite the unrest, the festival and Mali's slam poets have seen their support base grow. Jelimari Sissoko is an executive member of the Malian Federation of Artists. He teaches the kora, a West African string instrument, to students at the National Arts Institute. Sissoko says the slam poets are considered full-fledged musicians. He says they accept them as being musicians. At the festival, slam poet Diarra performed on stage for the first time in nearly a year. I have joy in my heart, she says. Like a child who could walk, suddenly fell ill and could not walk. Later, the doctor tells him that he will walk again, says Diarra. You can imagine the joy, she says. So I have this joy. Undeterred by the region's ongoing conflict and unrest at home, Mali slam poets, like Diarra, are passionate about their art and a better future for their country. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great day.